the journey is the account of Betty and Barney Hill, most of it as related under hypnosis. Much of the book is, in effect, a transcript of the tape recording made by their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon of Boston, during their treatment. Now, I don't want to go too far into this story because the story is far more fascinatingly told firsthand by our guests, who tonight are Betty and Barney Hill, who will be speaking to us long distance from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. But before we introduce Betty and Barney on the telephone, I would like you to meet our friend and your friend, the noted Cleveland ufologist and a member of NICAP, and also APRO and several other organizations, I'm sure, and himself an author and a distinguished lecturer, Mr. Earl Neff. He is an experienced investigator, and also he's a fascinating guy to have on as a guest. I never feel right doing any kind of a program about unidentified flying objects unless Earl is with me. Tonight, I'm particularly anxious to talk to Betty and Barney Hill, but before we do, I just wanted to tell you that the introduction to the book, The Interrupted Journey, is written, as I think I mentioned, by Benjamin Simon. And the reason for writing the introduction was to give the reader the documentation and the authority from the psychiatrist to reprint in certain sections of the book the transcript of his treatment of both Mr. and Mrs. Hill. I think it's very important to realize that this is not a story that has come from a person who has who feels they've had this experience alone. It rather comes not only from them, but it is documented as told to their psychiatrist under the influence of hypnosis. Hypnosis was the method of treatment, time being of the essence, that Dr. Simon chose to use. So the story has been reconstructed, in effect, or parts of it have, through bona fide hypnotic treatment by a distinguished Boston psychiatrist. I could read to you the entire excerpt from the 1966-67 Who's Who in the East 10th edition. There's about 42 inches worth of material in the columns on Dr. Benjamin Simon. Suffice to say that he is a distinguished, respected psychiatrist. All right, now, let's talk to Betty and Barney Hill, who are now on the telephone in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hello, which one have I got on the line, or have I got you both?
You have us both on.
Oh, how wonderful. Hello, that's you, Barney?
Yes, that's correct.
And Betty, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Betty,
okay.
How are you?
Oh, thank you.
You both met, by means of telephone at least, Mr. Earl Neff. He's with us tonight, too.
Hello, Barney and Betty.
Hi, Earl.
Good to hear your voice again.
Yes, it is a pleasure.
Thank you. Now, before we get started, and I know you've told this story time and time again, and told it fascinatingly, I'm going to express my gratitude to you in advance, both of you, Betty and Barney, for consenting to be on with us tonight.
Thank you.
Now, as I understand it, we have to go back to 1961 to start this whole incident, don't we?
Yes, that's right. September 19th, 1961.
That's when whatever happened.
Yes.
Where were you then, Barney?
Well, Betty and I were returning from a vacation trip in Canada, and we had left Montreal, Canada, arrived in New Hampshire, across the Canadian, American-Canadian border, about 9:30, close to 9:30 o'clock p.m. And we stopped in a small town, border town, called Colebrook, New Hampshire. And we had a refreshment with coffee and a hamburger. And we left approximately 10 o'clock, shortly after 10.
Mm-hmm.
When we, traveling south on Route 3, arrived in an area called Lancaster, New Hampshire, Betty called my attention to an object or a star that she had been watching, because she had noticed it, and she called my attention to it. But she could better tell what she had seen, because this would have been my first introduction to this star at all.
Betty, what was it you saw?
Well, I was really riding along in the Lancaster area. First of all, it was a beautiful night. It was a harvest moon, and it was quite bright. And down in the lower left-hand corner of the moon was a large star, which I learned later was the planet Jupiter. And suddenly, there appeared above this star a much larger star, which I had not been there, and then suddenly I saw it. And as I was watching, this star seemed to be getting larger and brighter. And we rode along, and I kept watching it, and then all of a sudden, I noticed that it had started to move. And it was at this time that I could really call Barney's attention to it. And we decided to stop, get out of the car with the binoculars, and take a look at it. At this time, we thought it was a satellite. So we did get out of the car, and we had 7 feet of... I've forgotten now the size of the binoculars.
7x50 power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we took turns watching this object, and it went across the face of the moon, and then made a sharp turn and started to come in towards our car. And when it started coming towards us, this is when we returned to the car, and Barney made the comment that he had seen us and was coming towards us. We got in the car and we started driving.
Now, how did you feel then, Barney? If you said it had seen you,
yes,
and was coming toward you.
Well, Alan, I think that remark would have been made because after Betty had called my attention to this and the star that was in the sky moving, my remark to her was that it was obviously a satellite. Prior to 1961, I was totally closed-minded about flying saucers or UFOs.
Yes.
So that this would have been a natural explanation for something distant, quite a distant out moving.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I said that it had now seen us and was coming toward us is because as rapidly from a star-like position, which means it was quite a distance away, it now had come in rapidly to where it was would have been close to. What I mean by close is that now it is something that you can see in the sky like a light with the sky in the background, you might say.
Would you say that it was just an offhand remark? You weren't frightened at that moment.
Well, I became frightened only because I then said, well, Betty, it is, in all probability, it is a commercial airliner going to Canada because it was traveling north when we initially saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it's probably a commercial plane on its way north somewhere.
Yeah.
And it made this peculiar turn that Betty described, where it turned toward Vermont, which is west of New Hampshire, and completing the turn, started coming in toward where we were parked on the highway, coming in toward us. Now, we are in the mountainous areas. You guys have to understand that, too.
Yeah.
So I became quite alarmed, and it was dark. At night, I thought of bears. I'm formerly from a city, and I kept thinking, well, what if bears came out of the woods there? This would have been quite frightening to me as well.
Yes.
So that I said, Betty, it has seen us, and we returned to the car and began traveling on Route 3, traveling south.
Yes.
Now, Betty would occasionally call my attention to the object. I would slow down, and sometimes I would make a complete stop because the object was now following, going along in the same direction we were going.
Mm-hmm.
That is, where it had been traveling north, it had now began traveling south, the direction we are traveling.
Yes.
So that it was off on the passenger side of the car, and we would occasionally stop. And I kept thinking, if one has ever been in open areas at night, you can see millions of stars, much more prominent in the sky than you can in the city. So that on occasion, when you're driving along at night, you can notice that a star seems to be moving along with the car motion. And I kept thinking, well, maybe this is what is happening. So I would stop the car, and the object was still moving. And this was peculiar too, because it was still moving, so I obviously had to rule out that it was a star, and it is following us to the south. Well, we arrived at an area called Franconia Notch, and there's Cannon Mountain there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tramway that goes up to the mountain that one can ride during the summer months up to the summit of the mountaintop. And the object went around the west side of the mountain, which would have been the Vermont. Well, we're in New Hampshire, but it would have been on that side.
Mm-hmm.
While the road itself, at the base of the mountain, travels around on the left side. And then traveling around on the left side at the base of this mountain, of Cannon Mountain. The object, when we came out south of Cannon Mountain, there's a natural rock formation called O Man of the Mountain. It's actually a landmark marking New Hampshire. We use it in many of the government brochures that is telling of sites and things to see on one visiting New Hampshire. So this is something that everyone is quite proud about, is this natural rock formation that looks like the face of a person, a profile. So the object was now front, you might say, in the front of us. And I came to another stop, and I looked, and I could see it. It was still off at a distance.
What did it look like to you now?
From this point, it looked like, in all respects, all probability, it looked like, and then I thought it was a Piper Club, because I thought that a fast-moving commercial plane couldn't travel that slow. So it must have been a Piper Cub, and this is what told Betty, there's nothing to get alarmed about. It's a Piper Cub. But I was getting quite frightened because of this, and I thought it must have been military pilots. They could obviously see us on the ground with the lights of the car on, and I thought they were playing a game with us out there. And when we arrived south of Indian Head, I use Indian Head as a landmark, but it's just a little south of Indian Head. Betty again called my attention to this, and she was very excited. She insisted that I stop again, because I was telling Betty that, well, now we have to get on to Port Pleasant. We can't bother ourselves with this, whatever it is out there. And I, as I said previously, military pilots, Piper Cub, commercial airliner, I kept putting it all in this kind of natural explanation. So she called my attention again. And I stopped the car, and now the object had descended to about 200 feet. It was on the passenger side of the car, not directly to the right, but in an oblique, more to the right headlight on that kind of an angle. I looked through the windshield, and I could see that, as I said, that it had descended to about 200 feet. I estimate this, and I am not good at that good at estimating distance. It was much closer. And I became determined then that I was going to find out what this is. It had to have some natural explanation. And this is as simple as that. I got out of the car, took the binoculars from the, where they were sitting between the seat, on the seat between Betty and I. I stepped away from the car, and lo and behold, the object then shifted across from the passenger side over the highway, over the field, which brought it over on the driver's side of the car now. Also in, you might say, an oblique position from the car's position that way. Not exactly to the passenger side of the car, but off front at an angle. And I began walking away. I began walking away from the car, across the highway, walked into the field, and I walked quite a distance. And I then, I'm looking at it with the binoculars, and I can't believe what I am seeing. Because now we have to understand that this is all and have always been in the conscious memory. I can't believe what I'm seeing, because with the binoculars I can discern what I call figures moving about at a huge plate glass that seems to curve around. And this was so baffling, because I kept thinking, there's nothing, there's, I can't believe in flying saucers, UFOs, and this is just incredible. And I wanted to hear a sound, a noise of some kind of motor that would cause this thing to be able to be hovering there in a stationary position. I failed to mention that when I made this stop, this particular stop, Betty also had seen two red lights on the side of the craft, and I, when I stepped from the car, I could see the same two red lights. Now, after it had shifted across the highway, these figures that were looking seemingly down toward me, because the object was tilted at a downward motion, the plate glass, this huge glass, was tilted towards the ground, you might say, at a slight angle.
At an angle that would have enabled the occupants to look down.
Yes, that's correct. I could see they, well, I have said that all the figures then, if I think, with the exception of one, moved away as if to take just one, no more than two steps from the plate glass, and I could see with the binoculars what I thought were arms going out, touching or pulling on levers. For lack of a better thing to say, I called them levers.
Yes.
The two red lights that were now part of the craft began to move out and away, becoming the extension of a fan or fin-like type wing.
Yes.
Not long wings that you find on planes, but more of a fin-like kind of wing, and the two red lights would have been at the tip of this,
mm-hmm.
and it became the extension
mm-hmm.
of these wings. And I was just completely baffled by the entire experience standing here seeing this incredible thing. And I pulled the binoculars away from my eyes, dashing back to the car, screaming to Betty, "Oh my God," I said, "Betty, this is going to capture us." I entered the car, put it into gear, and I thought I could see as I passed, as I mentioned, it was in an oblique position towards the front, left front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
You follow my point?
Yes.
So that when I began driving down the highway, the object, I thought, shifted overhead. And there was a series of beeps, and Betty was saying, "I don't see it, I don't see it." And there was this series of beeps. Beep, 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 beep. And the car vibrated very subtly.
Yes.
And,
Could you sense where those beeps, if there was a vibration, where the vibration was coming from?
I felt it with my hands on the steering wheel. I felt it tingling on the steering column. Betty has mentioned that, but she hasn't mentioned it yet, but she has told me that she reached and felt the dash panel. And we all wondered, well, where is this subtle vibration coming from? It was not a violent vibration.
Yes.
The vibration was much, the description I have given is like a tuning fork being struck and placed against one's arm.
Yes.
And that's just a subtle vibration. And this is the way the car vibrated from the beeping sound that we heard.
And the vibration seemed to coordinate with the beeping
with
sound.
With the beeps, yes.
All right, now I'm going to stop you at this point in your story, Barney. And Barney Hill is recounting, ladies and gentlemen, this story from his conscious memory. It is most important to realize that there was a lapse. What you're going to hear next in the story is a reconstructed version. It took some years for Barney and for Betty Hill to find out what happened after they first heard the beeping sound and felt the vibrations inside the car. But I would like to pause for just a moment, if I may, and render a commercial. And then we'll get back to the story that we're listening to from Betty and Barney Hill speaking to us from Portsmouth, New Hampshire tonight. A very, very fascinating, if you will, a very weird, and yet a very strangely documented tale of an encounter with an unidentified flying object. And we will go aboard that unidentified flying object with Mr. and Mrs. Hill in a moment. And so will Earl Neff, our guest here in the studio tonight. We are talking, Earl Neff of Cleveland and I, with Betty and Barney Hill. And Betty and Barney live and are speaking to us tonight from their residence in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And we left them on Route 3, heading south and feeling a strange vibration in the car coordinated with beeps. And now let's get back to Barney and Betty. I wanted to ask, before we go on with the story, Betty, you were alone in the car with the dog while Barney ran out in the field with the binoculars. Now, what did you see from the car, and how did you feel then while Barney was off in the field?
Well, my first thought was, let me say, first of all, I had no fear whatsoever up to this point. I was fascinated by this, and I had a great deal of curiosity. When Barney stopped the car, he stopped it right directly in the middle of the highway.
Yes.
And so when he went out into the field, I was leaving the car, and I was watching in case of traffic, any car coming along.
Yes.
Then I would drive the car over to the side of the highway.
Yes.
So I was sitting here waiting for him, and I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, and he didn't come back. And it was at this point I began to get quite upset. And I found out later, under the hypnosis, that I became so upset, I was almost shrieking for him to come back to the car.
Yes.
And that if he did not hurry up and come back, I was going to go out and get him myself. And I then the door was open on the driver's side.
Yes.
And I tried to open it more, and I was going to slide out and go out into the field after Barney, when I heard him running back to the car. And then this is when he got into the car and said that they were going to capture us. And he was sort of a panic. He was sort of hysterical. He was very upset.
Yes.
And he immediately started driving the car. He was trying to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also telling me to look out and see if I could see them.
Yes.
Saying that they were directly overhead. I put the car window down and I stuck my head out the window and looked out. And I couldn't see anything. And so then I put the window back up, and it was just when I had completed doing this that we heard the beeping on the trunk of the car, and the car vibrated. And I was touching the metal, because I kept thinking, well, this is something electrical, and possibly there would be electricity. Maybe I could feel a shock from the metal of the car, but there was nothing.
Now, at this point, this is a critical point in the story. It is difficult to know quite where to go from here, because this is the point of the story at which you later realize that there were 2 hours missing in time.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps what we best do is follow you along home in your conscious memory to the point where you got home, and then reconstruct the story as it actually happened to you. And we'll do that in a moment, after I pause to remind our audience that we're talking with Barney and Betty Hill tonight. They are the subjects of the book, The Interrupted Journey, 2 hours, 2 lost hours aboard a flying saucer by John G. Fuller. It is now available. It's published by Dial. And if you are a ufologist, I strongly urge that you get this book. I think that this incident goes down as probably the best documented sighting of an unidentified flying object and confrontation with creatures in an object in the history of UFOs. Now, Betty and Barney will be with us, and so will Earl Neff. I feel impelled only through earthbound, egoistic urges to remind you that my name is Alan Douglas. Now, let's get back to the story that Betty and Barney are telling us. You proceeded onward then towards Portsmouth. From the time you first heard those beeps and felt the vibrations, was there any lag in time, in your conscious memory to the second time you heard them?
No, I would say that it was only later that we realized that this part was sort of missing.
May I say this?
Yes, honey.
And Betty, that later we also described another time when we heard these series of beeps. And Betty's remark to me was, well, now, Barney, do you believe in flying saucers? And I said, of course not, Betty, don't be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been in the Plymouth Ashland section of New Hampshire on Route 3.
This, incidentally, has always been the position that you had taken.
Yes. And we then proceeded on to Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't stop after this, but we would occasionally look skyward. We would slow down to a slow pace occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
We drove to Portsmouth. There wasn't much conversation between us from that point after the second beep to Portsmouth.
Yes.
Except that when we arrived in the city of Portsmouth, it was dawn. It was daybreak, and the sun was coming up. It was not night any longer. Now, this is the trip. It's approximately 170 miles from Colebrook, New Hampshire, to Portsmouth.
Yes.
And the speed of the highway is 50 miles an hour. So we assume that it should have taken us oh, I should say, at least 3 to 4 hours to get home.
Mm-hmm. It would have had you home about midnight.
Yes. Well, no, we left Colebrook at 10 o'clock. We should have arrived, I would say, around 2 o'clock in the morning.
2 a.m., right?
Yes, but when we arrived, it was after 4, closer to 5,
mm-hmm.
when we arrived in Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Betty was very determined that I not bring the car refrigerator we had with food in it, fresh food, that is, not that I would not bring it into the house, that I would carry it around to the back stoop and place it there because she wanted to discard all this food, and I wondered why, and she just felt that she didn't want it in the house and we shouldn't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
We entered the home and we felt unclean, more than just the accumulation of dirt and grime one would get from a trip,
yes.
But we felt soiled, in a soiled kind of uncleanliness.
And I
went into the bathroom, took a mirror, and examined my body for no reason. I wasn't looking for anything, but I just felt as if something had touched me, and I wasn't sure what it was, and I wanted to look around and see, and I didn't see or find anything. Well, this is basically what would have happened. Betty and I retired then, and we awakened several hours later in the late afternoon. We vowed we would never tell anyone about this, and we decided that we would draw a picture of what we thought this thing looked like and compare our drawings. So Betty went into one room and I the other. We drew our pictures, we brought them together, and we looked at them, and there was the similarity of the structure of what we were trying to draw. So our drawing techniques are basically, we're not artists by any stretch of the imagination, but there was the similarity. Well, Betty then called her sister. We weren't going to tell anyone, you know. So she called her sister and told her sister about it and also remarked about the beak because she was very upset about this. And her sister called back a few minutes later telling us that she had talked with her sister's friend of hers, and he had suggested that if there was beeping and the tingling sensation that Betty had described, to go out and take a look at her car, if she had anything she could use to take it with her, and one suggestion was a compass.
Yes.
So we found the compass, and this is interesting. Many people have questioned, why did we have a compass? Did we have binoculars? The only answer is...
You're campers, aren't you?
Pardon me?
You're campers, aren't you?
We're campers. We love it. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, we live on the coast, and we're only about 3 miles from the ocean, so that anyone living by the sea, we enjoy sitting on the beach looking out at the ocean liners going up the coast occasionally, coming into Portsmouth, as well as going into the mountain areas and going up on the summit of some mountain and then looking off at the vast distances and trying to pick out objects with the binoculars. So this is just standard equipment.
Yeah, I would say that any rational mind will grant you a pair of binoculars and a compass.
Yes. So that Betty went out and she came into the house very, very upset now. And I had told her to keep me out of this and not to involve me with a conversation with her sister or any of this.
Yes.
Well, we have tenants living in our apartment at that time. This young man and his wife that were living in our apartment, that is the building, we have on the building itself, they knew we had been on vacation and they could hear us talking, and so they came down to ask about our trip. And Betty, they noticed, was very excited and was trying to get me to go look at her car. And they went out, took a look, and they came in. They said, Barney, you should go out, take a look at the car and see what there are large spots on it. So I went out reluctantly and took a look, and there on the trunk of the car were very large, shiny spots about the size of silver dollars. Now, these spots were the same color of the car, because this has been a misconception.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have thought that they were different in color, but it was the same color of the car, only as if it had been highly polished, just in a circle of polish.
I see.
And there must have been around 15 to 20 of these spots in no particular pattern, just spotted throughout the trunk.
Around the trunk area?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And when placing the compass over the spot, the compass would revolve very erratically. The reason I wasn't too interested about taking the compass out, because I knew that a car would invariably, or any kind of metal of this type, would attract the magnet of the compass toward it.
Yes.
So I didn't find anything too upsetting about that, except that when putting turning the compass over to the spots, then it would theoretically revolve.
Yes.
So Betty then decided there's only one thing to do with this. That is to notify Pease Air Force Base, which is a SAC base in our town, in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And she called. I told her, well, okay, you may, but you mustn't give my name or tell anything about me. Well, this was ridiculous on my part, because obviously she had to say that her husband was with her on vacation.
Yeah.
And their next, after questioning her, their next action would have been, well, now let us speak to your husband.
Yeah.
So I then got involved. But as I have pointed out in the book that Mr. Fuller has written documenting this story,
mm-hmm.
I pointed out that after talking with these officers by phone at Pease, I felt a great relief because they handled it with great dignity, you might say,
yes.
In a very official way, and as if this was the responsible thing that she and I should have done, is to report it to them.
Yes.
They also said that we were going to be hooked up with another phone. They didn't tell us at this time, and it would be monitored. We later learned that this would have been a hookup to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where we again told the same story.
Yes.
And that, they called back a few times to ask us about details concerning the structure of the craft, its maneuverability, et cetera, and so forth. And that was the only official interview we had with the military.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever came out to the house. Betty, meanwhile, obtained some books from the library because neither of us knew anything about the so-called UFO flying saucer. And she was quite interested now to find out just what did we see. And these books that she went down to the library to obtain, one contained information about reporting sightings to NICAT.
Yes.
Our National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomena. So she jotted off a letter to NICAP, and then they sent an investigator out to visit us from Boston. They're located in Washington, the headquarters,
mm-hmm.
but they have investigators throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
So Walter Webb, might call him astronomer, he's a lecturer at Eaton Planetarium, came to interview us. And I found out later that he did this with great reluctance, because there was the mention of me having seen could discern figures inside the craft.
Yes.
But after arriving later, he said he was very impressed with the sincerity of both Betty and I certainly did respond to Walter when he came to the house. Intelligent young man, I thought, well, I didn't know what was going to come to visit me concerning this kind of a story. Other scientists became interested. They heard of this throughout now that we had reported it to NICAP, and they furnished a newsletter to their subscribers, so that we never volunteered any of this information to any news media,
mm-hmm.
Because we didn't want this kind of publicity. So these other scientists got interested in it, and they paid visits to us from different states, different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And while going over this one day, we must have spent about 12 hours going over this great depth when they came up with the idea that if we realized that from the time we left Colebrook and the time we arrived in Portsmouth was closer to 6 hours than 4 hours,
mm-hmm.
which it should have taken.
Yes.
Well, we were sort of... Well, we hadn't really realized it. Plus the fact that why, after my dashing back to the car, an Indian head screaming something's going to capture us, Betty's remark later is, do you believe in flying saucers? And we have to understand that when I made this remark at Indian head and then the next series of beeps occurred in the Plymouth-Ashland area, and this is approximately 30 to 35 miles apart.
Yes.
And we could never fill in, we could never think and understand exactly what we had been doing from the first beep to the second beep.
Yes.
Except to say that while I was driving the car after I ran back at Indian Head, I was driving, and when the second beeps occurred in the Plymouth area, I'm driving the car, and... Well, I don't know why she didn't tell me or ask me what's going to capture us, you see.
No, yes, no. Along with these scientific inquiries that you were so laboriously calmly and, I'm sure, interestingly, answering. Both you and Betty had begun to have dreams. Had the dreams begun by this time?
Well, Betty had these dreams 10 days after the sighting in 1961,
mm-hmm.
and they lasted for only 5 days.
I see.
This is very important because she did not dream of UFOs afterwards. I did not have dreams.
You had none?
I had not.
Betty dreamed for five consecutive days?
5 consecutive days.
And what was the dream like, Betty?
You care to tell Betty?
Well, actually, we found out later that my dreams were very, very similar to the information that we obtained under hypnosis. There were some minor differences, and I think probably the most important difference is that in my dreams, I made the occupants, I might say, more human than they were under the hypnosis.
Well, now, that leads us. I know that there's a great deal more to the story, but I think what we had better do now is go back to that moment just after the first beeping. Now, in order to do that, if I may very rapidly fill in our audience in the interest of time, Betty and Barney Hill were so disturbed by the dreams that Betty had had. Is that true? Barney had had none.
Barney had no dreams.
But Betty had had dreams, and you were disturbed by these dreams.
Yes.
And you sought the help of a psychiatrist. Or a psychologist was it the first?
I think I have to structure this in a proper way. It's after Betty had had these dreams. Then it was a matter of her later when Walter Webb came to interview us,
mm-hmm.
telling him and filling in the entire story. She did mention about the dreams. When the other two scientists came to inquire about this sighting, she mentioned to them. She had also told me about the dreams.
Yes.
And my conclusion was that is exactly what you have had. Dreams, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
But when they decided that there was a missing period here of approximately 2 hours, also that it was obvious that we both had suffered amnesia at Indian Head, and we did not come out of this amnesia state until Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very baffling because this is highly improbable for two people to suffer amnesia at the same time.
Yes.
Well, then this is when we, and this is a few months after she had her dreams, we began hoping to find a qualified psychiatrist, preferably a person trained in the medical profession,
yes.
to conduct this hypnosis. We had an interview with one psychiatrist in Massachusetts, and he, after observing us, said that both of you people, I felt pleased about this because he gave us the assurance that we were not hallucinating and that we were seeing.
Yes.
But he felt that since the experience was very recent, sit on it for a while and possibly it will open up, the amnesia might open up in a natural way.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been very soon after the sighting when we had this appointment with the psychiatrist to conduct the hypnosis. Now, I had an ulcer that had not bothered me for months and years, but it then began to bother me. And it did not respond to any medication from the medical doctor. And so he then decided, well, possibly it had some kind of psychological origin or cause that continued, that it persisted in causing this distress with me,
mm-hmm.
the ulcer itself.
Yes.
So he suggested, based on some of the things I had told him about my son, teenagers, and they were in another state, and they wouldn't write, and I would get upset because I wasn't getting the kind of correspondence. But Betty would say, well, after all, this is teenagers, but, you know, boys don't like to write.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't satisfying me, and so now I'm telling this to the psychiatrist as a part of why I had been upset, thinking this was the reason for the ulcer.
Yes.
But I one day mentioned to him how Betty and I had seen a UFO, and as a result of it, well, it looked as if we both had amnesia at the same time, because, and then I filled him in briefly with what we knew.
Mm-hmm.
So he recognize that this was possibly the cause of my ulcer. Two people, Betty had had her nightmarish dream several years ago. That is, they ran for 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still plaguing or bothering her several years later.
Yes.
My ulcer not responding to medical medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And we are primarily concerned about an experience that has happened in 1961. This is now the latter part of 1963.
Yes.
He then recommended that he would establish an appointment with us to visit this psychiatrist in Boston, Dr. Benjamin Simon, a very qualified, prominent psychiatrist, and well, you might say, qualified to regress one back.
Yes.
With the use of hypnotherapy.
Yes. Now, it was Dr. Simon who elected to use hypnotherapy because it was a more expedient means.
This is what he determined after the consultation.
Mm-hmm.
We established an appointment. Both Betty and I were together when we kept this appointment, and he immediately could recognize that we both had had amnesia at the same time, and that he then decided that one way of opening the amnesia itself. It could possibly be the technique of regressive hypnosis.
All right. Now, at the point at which Dr. Simon began to treat both of you using hypnosis,
yes.
Let's go back now and reconstruct from that first moment on the highway on Route 3 heading south when you heard those beeps. Rather than go into Dr. Simon's office, I think it would be better now for you to tell us what you now have had opened up to you through hypnosis and through the psychiatric treatment of Dr. Simon.
Yes.
Let's go back to those first beepings and pick up the story from there and reconstruct those missing 2 hours.
Well, I first was carried through the experience in a regressive recall by Dr. Simon.
Yes.
And I also would like to point out that at no time during whenever information was being extracted from us while in a deep trance, were Betty and I in the same room together. I would spend maybe an hour in a deep trance telling him, and the doctor would then leave a post-hypnotic suggestion that I would not remember anything that I had told him. And we do the same with Betty. In this way, it prevents us from telling each other what we were telling the doctor while we regress back to that period.
Yes, it's very unusual for one psychiatrist, as I understand it, to treat two people, particularly a man and wife. But in this instance, because of this dual experience, each of you having experienced the same thing, I can see where the course of treatment and the method of one psychiatrist handling both patients was a logical and an ethical expedient.
Yes.
Okay.
So now, under regressive hypnosis, after returning to the car, while out in the field, it seems as if there was some communication between this object hovering in the sky. I could always remember one person continuing to stand at the plate glass, looking back at me while the others moved away from the glass itself, reaching up, as I described as reaching to a water panel.
Yes.
Except this one, they continued to stare back at me. Now, under regressive hypnosis, it seemed as if I was being compelled to come closer to this craft, actually being told to come close to the craft.
Yes.
Now, we have to realize that the craft is approximately 100 feet away from me, up in the air. It's not on the ground at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there was this kind of communication that I was receiving. Plus, I had my binoculars up to my eyes, and I was also told to keep them there, not take them away.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled them. Somehow, the tapes of the hypnosis were very emotional, and I screamed and pulled the binoculars from my eyes, And I also broke the straps. Now, I failed to mention that when we returned to Portsmouth, later I was looking at my binoculars, I noticed the strap was broken, and I wondered if Betty had somehow broken the straps, and then I questioned my sons and asked if they had broken my straps. I never knew all those months until now, regress back to that period standing in the field, and then pulling the binoculars from my eyes with such force, they parted, the straps parted from around my neck.
So then you were really violently afraid.
Yes, and then I dashed back to the car, and then upon entering the car, there was a series of beeps, and there was this oblivion where I didn't remember anything. But under regressive hypnosis, where I am made to recall exactly what I am doing, I am driving the car, and I drive further south on Route 3, where I leave Route 3, driving off into a very desolate spot, or part of the mountain section, where there is no car traffic at that time of night. Incidentally, there wasn't any traffic on Route 3, because we have to realize this is after Labor Day, up there in the White Mountains after September 7th. It is a very desolate spot at night.
Yes. But so you turned off Route 3.
I turned away. I drove off of Route 3 and into a very desolate wooded area.
Even under the regressive treatment, can you recall any motive for turning off?
Yes, I'm being told to. I'm actually being told, even after returning to the car, it seemed as if, and I used the words of mine, if there had been damage done to me, it was done at that time I was standing in the field, because it seemed as if, even after returning to the car, I'm being directed to drive down to this spot and leave the highway where I made this left turn, and I continue to drive, and then suddenly there are these men standing in the road. Upon getting into this desolate area spot, I suddenly saw a huge orange glow. Now, this is interesting because both Betty and I consciously remembered somehow of seeing an orange ball in the road.
Yes.
But we could never go any further than somehow we could see and always remember an orange ball in the road. And our remark was that, well, it must have been the moon. And then we dismissed it.
Yes.
But now, under regressive hypnosis, I can see this orange ball diminishing in bright, in from orange as a bright color, into a duller color, where it eventually the light is completely out, it's just darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And these men are standing in the road, several of them, beckoning for me to halt. Well, the car stopped. Now the car stopped, and I am trying to get it going, and I don't get any ignition. The lights are out. I'm very confused. I'm in a total state of confusion, and I started to get out of the car. I had a tire iron that I had taken from the trunk of the car further back on Route 3.
Yes.
When we were watching this thing before we had arrived at Indian Head.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get to that, and the door was open, and there were these men standing by. And I thought, well, are they going to rob me? And then one pulled me from the car, not in a violent way, but more or less as if I was hardly complying. And I stepped from the car where they literally dragged me, though I was in an upright position, down and around the car and into the woods and to where there is, I could see the dark outline of a physical structured kind of thing.
Now, Barney, can you describe, are you able to describe what these men looked like, how they were dressed?
Well, when I saw them standing in the headlights of the car before the lights went out, they were in dark, similar kind of garment, and I called it a uniform, which I thought as a pea jacket. I also understand, Alan, that in critical situations, we continually try to put things into the frame of reference that we can identify with as a natural thing.
Yes.
So that I thought of the uniforms being much like a navy pea jacket.
Barney?
Yes.
May I interrupt just 1 second?
Sure.
Was the one of these six people or creatures on the road wearing a visor on a cap?
No.
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 But I think that you had told me at one time that in the glass partition up above, as you were looking up, one appeared to have like a cap.
A military cap,
yes,
on.
But that you did not now recognize.
No, I did not recognize any cap.
Thank you.
Well, but while in the field at Indian Head, I described one that I was looking with the binoculars at that continued to stay at this panel glass as having on a military type visor cap. So I was taken from the car, and I actually was very limp, and as I pointed out, dragged toward the woods, and I was being told that no harm would come to me and to keep my eyes closed. And I was then carried up a ramp. This is interesting because Betty had never mentioned ramp in her dream. I was carried up a ramp where my feet struck against a high rise at the door jamb.
Yes.
Where they bumped over this object, and this was sort of a fleeting thing of recognizing that my feet are bumping something, you might say. And I opened my eyes just fleetingly, and I could see this corridor that curved around the inside of the glass, where the rooms were in on the inner side of the corridor.
Yes.
I was carried past one door into another door, and there was this room with a pie shape, as I described it, much like a pie, with the point of the pie cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one table that was very small for my body. I'm about 5'8", where I lied down. I got onto the table myself, and I am continually hearing this voice that is telling me that no harm is going to come to me. It's only a matter of a few tests that are going to be conducted. Just a simple, more or less, remain calm, and it will soon be over with, and I'll be about my business with no damage done.
Now, Barney, when you say you continually keep hearing this voice,
yes,
it's a voice that you apparently are hearing with your mind, but you're not hearing anybody speak, are you?
Well, I am hearing it much. Under deep hypnosis, I gave the doctor what I considered an analogy about explaining this circumstance and the situation. Sometimes it's difficult to explain things in abstract terms, to find the words to fit the picture.
Yes.
But I explained it to the doctor while I was in a deep trance, by Dr. Simon, that though I had a sense of awareness in deep trance in the doctor's office,
yes,
and he was sitting across from me, once I had been placed into a deep trance, I no longer knew that he actually was sitting across from me, but I knew that somewhere he was surrounded in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear his voice. I could hear his voice, but I couldn't tell. If I was asked to point out in a direction where the voice is coming from, I wouldn't have been able to tell.
I understand.
Does this give you the
yes.
feeling that I'm trying to describe
yes.
at this time?
You definitely did hear with your ears.
Well, I could hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
We get into the matter of, did they speak English? I don't know. I only know that I knew what was expected of me, and I complied. A sort of a willingness on my part and great fear and terror to comply with the belief that I had been assured that no harm was going to come to me, and I would go along with this, and eventually and hopefully to be on my way.
In any case, you are totally without a will of your own, is that it?
Oh, correct. This is the best way is to say I did not have any will of my own. I offered no resistance, no... I wasn't even concerned about Betty's whereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a little guilty as a father, a husband,
yes.
To not be concerned about my wife. But this is such a terrifying situation that I was only concerned about myself, and I was being assured that I wasn't going to be harmed.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was placed on this table where my trousers were removed, and my shirt was pulled up toward my head, which would have made my back, my undershirt was pulled up along with it, where my back would have been bare.
Mm-hmm.
And I was turned over on my back and my stomach, as well as I could feel what I called a fingers going up and down the spinal column. I could feel this. And I kept thinking, you know, Alan, when I tell this, I still feel very uncomfortable.
Yes, I can tell that as you as you're describing the experience aboard the craft, that you're very upset, and I sense that Betty is upset too. Is it true?
Somewhat.
It is.
We do build up pressure when we talk about
yes.
passages.
It's not a matter of being on the radio, because you have been on before.
Yes.
does do something to you, apparently, to recount this experience now.
We have a copy also of the tapes of us under regressive hypnosis, and it must have taken a year before Betty and I could sit down and really listen to the entire contents. Now, we're all in the doctor's office when he played the tapes back, funneling this back into our conscious memory. This was the reason he decided to record this on tape.
Was this the method by which he fed this back to you?
This was a part of the method.
Mm-hmm.
He also used certain post-hypnotic suggestions while we were in a treatment, too.
Just by way of interest, how long did the entire treatment take from the time Dr. Simon began to treat you until you finished?
From January until the early part of July.
January through July.
Yes.
And this was once every week, or?
This was every week.
Mm-hmm.
Every Saturday morning, Betty and I paid a visit to his office.
May I pause for just a moment, Barney and Betty? We'll be back in just a moment to continue this fantastic, fascinating tale told to us tonight by Betty and Barney Hill, speaking to us long distance from their residence at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Earl Neff is visiting with us tonight. Earl is a noted Cleveland ufologist and documenter, and I have never seen Earl so quiet. On the other hand, you've never heard me shut up to this extent. But I must say that I am enjoying this story as it is told so completely and so rationally by Betty and Barney Hill. Earl, you want to say something?
I would like to say that many times people ask me, both on radio or by letter, by phone, where they can learn about things like this. Well, the best way to learn is to go to organizations where these things are discussed. In the Cleveland area, the Cleveland Ufology Project, one of the fine organizations, been in existence for many years, and we meet the third Saturday of every month at 8 to 11 p.m., and this is in Parma. It's about a block beyond Snow Road on Pearl.
My name, incidentally, is Alan Douglas, listening to the fascinating tale, a fascinating story of Betty and Barney Hill and their two lost hours. I would like very much to convey to the audience my impression at this moment of Betty and Barney Hill. These are two extremely intelligent and sensitive human beings. And I find from this experience that I have a tendency to like them. I think that I would find them as friends if I knew them better. Let me say that the story that we are hearing is a story that is documented in the opinion of a noted Boston psychiatrist as being told by two people who implicitly believe it. And I think this is very important to remember. Now, back to you, Barney, and this experience of having been physically examined. Did you ever determine in your own mind what it may have been they were looking for, what they were trying to learn from you?
No, I have not, Alan. I'd like to just go back and elaborate just briefly on your last remark.
Yes.
About callers. This doesn't distress me. When you understand why we have released this information.
Yes.
Number one, after the regressive hypnosis, we then decided that we would never let this go any further.
Right.
It would all be continually investigated on the scientific level. Well, we had friends, and so we would occasionally tell a close friend and confidant. Well, they have friends, and so they would tell their friend and confidant.
Uh-huh.
And in a military town, the story eventually got out, and it really spread. But this is only by word of mouth. And a reporter in Massachusetts heard of it one day, and he decided to investigate.
Is it John Luttrell?
Yes. And he called us to ask for verification of what he had pieced together, and we asked him not to write the story.
Yes.
But the story was written anyway without our cooperation.
It's strange. Newspaper people have a kind of a penchant for that.
So we then began, this is when the pressure was on us, because we then began getting the the misconceptions of the newspaper article. People would ask, well, now when you took a trip to Venus or when you were on Mars or what was it like on the moon?
Yeah.
This upset me very badly because we had never said any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another visit with Dr. Simon and we discussed this thoroughly. And he decided that for our well-being, it would be best for the total documentation to come out. The facts, and this is all we consented to do, is to release all the facts pertaining to this entire experiment,
yes,
experience, and the reader would have to make their own decision. So if one can't believe the story, this is only natural. I would find it difficult to believe myself if I heard of this kind of story, so that it is the support of the regressive, the regression back to that period of time, the qualification of the psychiatrist that it was involved. These are the reasons that I can tonight talk to you over the phone and tell you about the documentation.
Well, then, in a way, the fact that this story got out has, if anything, strengthened you, hasn't it? The fact that the story got out and then subsequently had to be documented.
Yes.
It is a full story with all of the facts released as you know them,
yes,
and as you believe them to be.
Yes.
This has sort of strengthened you as an individual, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think I have misgivings about it occasionally.
Really?
Sometimes I don't feel too happy about it, and then there are other times that I feel that, well, the story was going to be told. It would have to be told. Even if someone heard about it, it would have been written somehow or another.
Mm.
So these are just circumstances, and this is it.
Mm.
But with this examination, I remembered a tug at my teeth, and this is the way I described it. And also, while on this, in this position of being examined, I opened my eyes again fleetingly because I could hear a kind of noise of as if people or someone was talking. I opened my eyes and I looked and I saw these three short men. And this is when I got a good look at the face. And I immediately closed my eyes because what I saw was terrifying by our standards.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that they were terrifying, you see.
Well, how would you describe what you saw?
I saw this kind of grayish color. And this is interesting because most people, they know when you saw the little green men, and they were not green men.
Mm-hmm.
They were a grayish metallic kind of gray in color. And I might also say that I'm quite sure they were not wearing a mask, or rather any kind of apparatus over the head for breathing purposes, because I could see what would have been a mouth, a thin line, without a lip muscle, that when parting, when opened, there was a membrane inside that fluttered at the, really right at the end of the mouth itself. And this fluttered, and this seemed to be a way that they communicated with one another, with a very peculiar kind of mumbling, humming sound. And as I also tried to give an analogy here, is the sound we have heard when someone in a commercial is speaking underwater. We have all been acquainted with that.
Yes.
In cartoons where you hear something underwater and it has that kind of a sound.
Gurgling sound.
A gurgling sound. And this was very baffling, and the head was, the cranium was very large, diminishing down toward the chin into a very small chin.
Mm-hmm.
And the eyes were very, very distinguishing because they were very large at the front of the face, but only continued back. I did not notice ears. I did not, I can't remember seeing ears.
Yes.
But the eyes continued back where you might say our ears are located, which would have meant that they were quite long and large in size. I said that they were not like an oriental eye, but yet you might say that we would think of an oriental eye.
How tall were these men?
They were approximately, I would say, 4.5 to 5 feet in total height.
Mm-hmm.
No taller than that. And also that there was the absence of the nose as we understand it, but just the nostrils and two slits.
No. No. There was an absence of a nose and just a nostrils in two slits.
Yes.
Now, Betty, you described in your dream that you had more or less in your dreams reconstructed these individuals. types of people through the normal process of identification, perhaps. But now, in your regressive hypnosis, how did you envision these people? How do you now recollect them? Are they similar to Barney?
Yes. I think the probably the most significant factor to me would be the eyes.
Now, I'm going to ask Earl Neff, who has a piece of information that neither of you, I don't believe, could possibly know about unless you have been in much closer contact with some NICAP people and some investigators, and perhaps we realize. But I think it's very important now, at this point, after this description of these creatures, to have Earl tell us about another experience that took place, I believe, a few years previous to yours in Brazil. Earl, can you very quickly tell Betty and Barney about
it? A gentleman by the name of Antonio Villas Boas. And he was a 23-year-old chap. I learned about this through Carl Lorenzen, the woman who heads the, with her husband James, heads APRO organization, the oldest organization of its kind in the world. And this took place, this incident took place in Minas Gerais, Brazil, at 1:30 a.m. on the morning of October 15th, 1957. It was a very strange event that took place, and it somewhat parallels, in a way, what you folks have experienced. There are two nights of manifestations of strange lights near the farm of his parents, and this was near this town of Francisco de Sales in the state of Minas Gerais, Brazil. The first two incidents were witnessed by Antonio's brother, Joa. This young man was riding, he was plowing a tractor, he was riding on it in a field near his home, when his attention was arrested by what appeared to be a very bright star. This, again, you see relatively parallels yours there in the beginning. And which he shortly realized afterwards was not a star at all, but a brilliantly lit egg-shaped object approaching at high speed. And shortly it was hovering overhead at an altitude of about 175 feet and illuminated the ground with a bright red light. Antonio more or less panicked, but realized he couldn't escape the thing because of the soft plowed ground in the field, and so he sat there rooted to his tractor seat, you might say. As he sat there, the object moved again and settled slowly to the ground about 15 yards away, and he got a very good look at it. Now, it looked like an elongated egg, sort of a torpedo-shaped or cigar-shaped, with small purplish lights all over it, a huge red light on the leading end, and three metal bars protruding from the end. And on the top of the object was something which rotated at high speed and gave off a sharp fluorescent red light. This began to turn green the moment the object slowed, probably in preparation for landing. But as it slowed, the top became more visible and appeared as a round plate or squashed cupola. Three props or metal legs emerged from the underside of this craft, and at this point, Antonio was thoroughly frightened and attempted to move the tractor away. And then the tractor quit and the lights went out. Now, this probably is due to electromagnetic force fields. He tried to start the engine, but was unsuccessful. And then he opened the door of the tractor, jumped out, and started running. At this point, he was caught short by something that grasped his arm. As he turned to shake off the pursuer, and he came face to face with a small figure dressed in gray striped suit with a strange helmet which entirely covered the head, showing only the eyes through a faceplate. There were tubes that led from the top of this helmet to a point on the suit at the back of it. Then Antonio pushed the creature and started running, and whereupon he was grabbed by three other creatures, all a little taller than the first one. He was then lifted and dragged to the ship. Now, as I remember, Barney, when you were speaking before they were taking you up on this ramp, they more or less dragged you, and as I recall, too, the toes of your shoe more or less were scuffed. Is that correct? He occasionally called for help, even cursing his captors. Further on, he speaks of where sometime later, in fact, the door of this object opened. He was in, by the way, I might go back a little ways and state that it was sort of a bed-like thing that he was asked to lie down on, and this was covered with a soft gray material and situated in the center of the room. It was curiously humped up in the middle. It was then, while he was lying down, that he noted the presence of tiny holes in the walls which were giving off a grayish vapor. Sometime later, the door opened, and two of the men led a woman into the room and then closed the door and left. Now, the woman is described in this manner. She was about 4 feet 6 inches tall. She was fair-skinned, blue-eyed, and darkly outlined, wide-set, slanted eyes, which gave her the look of an ancient Egyptian painting. Her hair, however, was blonde and nearly white, you might say, and it was short, extending only to about an inch or two below the earlobes. This was parted in the middle and turned under slightly. Her face was very broad through the cheekbones, which seemed to be quite pronounced, and tapered to a very pointed small chin. Her nose appeared to be normal, but her mouth was only a slit, completely without lips. She was well-formed, and this was quite easy to see as she was completely naked. And all in all, gave the general impression of a very beautiful woman. Now, the woman's purpose was instantly obvious, for she set about to seduce Antonio, succeeding twice. After the second act was completed, the woman was called for by the two men and left the room. But just before leaving, she pointed to Antonio, then she pointed to her stomach, then down toward the earth, and to what he thought was the southern sky, and smiled. Then he was given his clothes and all except his cigarette lighter and courteously taken us from the ship. But I thought you should know about this. There's more, but I don't want to take time to tell you.
Has anybody told you about this incident at all?
No, I haven't heard of it.
Well, I don't know how you feel having the incident related to you, but there are some striking points of similarity. And both Earl and I were talking about this earlier this evening, and Earl pointed out that there could be, in all probability, no way for you to know of this particular experience.
I hadn't heard of it. This other part of this seduction, nothing like that took place with me, but I described a cup-like object being placed over my lower...
Over the groin?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel it being placed, and as if there was some kind I was thinking of the word vibration, but this doesn't describe what I am trying to say. As if something was movable in a soft way, and it was placed over me, and then it was removed. I don't know the reason for it, but this is where I later developed the warts that came on my body.
And Betty, as I understand it, you they were interested in performing what they described to you, you say, as a pregnancy test.
Well, this is what they called it. This was the threading of a needle-like apparatus of some kind into my navel.
Mm-hmm. And it was painful at first, you say?
It was quite painful, yes. And I was very upset, even when I realized what they were going to do and asked them not to do this. And seemed to think it would not...
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to be quite surprised that it did.
Yes.
And the one I called the leader, rubbed his hands in front of my eyes, and the pain went away.
I see. Now, when the pain went away, did you ever feel any discomfort or pain afterward in any of your conscious memory?
No.
No discomfort?
No, not that I could remember.
Did you feel impelled at any time to have yourself examined by a doctor? Of course, this all came later, didn't it?
Yes, this was the experience itself happened in 1961, and mm-hmm. the hypnosis was in 1964.
So
there was quite a time lapse here.
Yes.
And but I wasn't aware of this.
I see.
And I never did think of going to a doctor about it.
Mm-hmm. And so you weren't even aware of that part of the experience until you, several years later, were regressed hypnotically.
That's right.
Barney, what about the rash on your back?
Warts.
These were warts on your back.
On the groin. Mm-hmm.
Yes. The doctor took the position that these warts were, or I might say, could have been of a natural development.
Well, I tell you, it's a heck of a question to ever ask a doctor, because they haven't found out yet for sure what it caused my earthbound warts, right?
Yes.
So I guess we really can't answer that question, and we can't logically expect a doctor to as yet.
I asked the leader where he came from, and he stepped over by the wall and put his hand on the wall, and these panels flew back, and a map came out, which I believe would be called a sky map.
Mm-hmm.
And while the map was exposed, he asked me if I knew where the Earth was. And for that, I tell him I did not know there. And he acted a little disgusted with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get a look at the map. He did not say just where he came from
mm-hmm.
on it. But I noticed certain things about it. I did ask him, there was some lines. Heavy solid lines,
mm-hmm.
and then there were lighter solid lines and broken lines.
Yes.
And I asked him the meaning of these, and he said the heavy lines were trade lines, and the light lines were places that they go sometimes. Broken lines were expeditions.
I see. Trade lines.
Trade lines.
I see.
Yes.
And incidentally, it should be mentioned that that your sketches appear in the book, The Interrupted Journey.
Yes, they do.
And this would be, a more complete way of gaining an answer to that question. Perhaps both Betty and Barney will tell us how they feel about it and what they believe it to be.
Shortly after the sighting, and after the investigation by the scientists that became involved in this experience that Betty and I had, where they noticed that there seemed to have been amnesia experienced by both of us, we visited a psychiatrist in Massachusetts. And and I also mentioned how he had suggested that this was a very recent experience and possibly the amnesia would open up in a natural way where we would, in the course of time, began to remember.
Yes.
We never did. This resulted later in our going to Dr. Simon.
Well, as I understand it, I think the implication of the question may be slightly obscured, but what he really wanted to know was, is there a history of any mental disorder?
No, there is no history of any mental disorder.
And you had never previously,
no.
Either of you had an occasion to visit a psychiatrist?
No.
All right. I think that's really what the man wants to know.
Now, I'd like to also briefly make a statement concerning, as you point out, the matter of semantics concerning word of documentation.
Yes.
That what we mean when we say documented is that there is the existence of the tapes of Betty and I both regressed back while in a deep trance-like state,
mm-hmm.
articulating a set of experiences in the most controlled way,
mm-hmm.
The most scientific controlled way that a psychiatrist could possibly do it. And this is what is meant by documentation.
All right, very good.
Who received the final? Who did what magazine pay for this?
We have to understand that, obviously, when the story was publicized in one of the papers here in the East, that there was a great demand for people to want to know more,
mm-hmm.
because Betty and I weren't telling.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't told this reporter who wrote the story. If this demand became very great, there was tremendous pressure, plus, as I pointed out, much of the kind of remarks that were stated, untruths, fantasies, that are attributed to what we were supposed to have been doing when we had never said we had done any of those particular things. And we then, in releasing this material, contracts were drawn up. This is quite a standard procedure,
mm-hmm.
because once we became a part of exposure this way, obviously, it could not be expected of us, Betty and I, to let our names go out this way without some kind of expenses
being paid for the efforts. For instance, tonight I am employed. I work for the government as a postal worker, and quite obvious, tomorrow I'll have to be out there delivering my appointed rounds after having been up till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Let me point out this too. I think the question is probably well put, but I think it also needs to be pointed out that if I had found myself experiencing this kind of thing in my own consciousness, and if I had been impelled to go to a psychiatrist and to spend some 7 months in psychiatric care, incidentally, I presume that Dr. Simon does not provide a free service to anyone.
Betty and I paid for those services for 7 months, where we both were regressed back. This would have meant that both of us were paying the hourly rate.
Yes.
May I add something?
All right.
I also would like to say that from 1961, or up until the present time, Marty and I were trying to find out as much information and as much we could scientifically about this experience.
Yes.
We went to scientific conventions. We went to scientists and we spent a great many hours doing this, and not only that, we spent hundreds and hundreds of our own money in our own investigation of this.
Well, I was just going to add to that, Betty, that if I had experienced all of this as you have, I would have, and also had the fortune, the good fortune of having a best-selling author choose to document the experience in a book. I would have no compunction about signing my name to a contract either, and I would hesitate to choose anybody at random in this society who would, incidentally. I think that the question was well put, and I believe it to have been well answered.
Sure. Well, I didn't discern any noise.
Betty, did you?
No, I didn't either. When we saw the object coming in towards us, first of all, it appeared like a solid yellow light, like a star. And then as it came in closer, it gave a twinkling effect. When it was coming in towards us, I had the impression that it was slowing down. Also, there was a very erratic flight pattern. And this was another thing that I noticed. That time, there was no change in color. There was the twinkling effect. And then as it came in closer and we saw the window, we had the impression, I don't know how true it is, but we had the impression that the craft was spinning. And it was actually the windows that we were seeing.
It was a gradual change, diminishing from orange into dull and then blackness.
It was a different kind of symbols than I'd ever seen before. There was no resemblance to writing or printing. I couldn't say what it was. The printing went up in the lettering, the symbols went up and down rather than across.
Was the binding, Betty, in any way similar to our books?
Well, of course, I've only had it for a few moments.
Sure.
And I didn't really have too much chance to look at
it. A quick glance, did it look like a book?
I would say it looked like a book. Oh, I never thought about that. If the weight, I would assume that it probably would be about the same weight as one of our books, so I probably might have noticed a difference.
Did it look to you, Betty, that the book had been mechanically reproduced as one of our books might be, or could it have been hand-lettered? Did it appear more artistically done than might be done by a machine, for example?
That's difficult to answer, but I would say it didn't look as though it would be something that we would do in handwriting.
Well, maybe
it would be more like a published book.
You know, maybe the whole line of questioning along in this way, as far as publishing or hand lettered, would be illogical. I would assume that another, more advanced intelligence would at least have been able to discover the principle or the means of publishing books, and that if the book was indeed a book, then it was therefore done mechanically.
Yes. I would like to add that Dr. Simon did not say he did not believe.
I didn't read that anywhere either.
What Dr. Simon has hypothesized is that is only a theory that he would say. It's a theory.
Yes.
There is the possibility that there has been a dream transference, that Betty had a dream, and then I absorbed the dream, and it has become a part of my reality.
Yes.
Well, in asking how this could be done, there are several theories governing this matter. Number one, it was thought first that Betty talked in her sleep. Well, we would have to presume that she was talking complete sentences.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been asleep, and then I would have overheard her talking, and this way I would have absorbed it. This was obviously unsound to believe, because I was employed nights at this time in Boston, commuting daily or nightly from Portsmouth to Boston, where I worked that night. So Betty would have had her dreams with me not being there.
It might also be added that if this were this kind of transference, which Dr. Simon, incidentally, notes is exceedingly rare, it would also have to be pointed out that in Betty's dream, there are points of difference between the dreams and between the hypnotic regression. And I think in as much as these points of difference exist, I think this discounts the theory that it could be transference even more.
I am willing to accept the dream transference. I can accept that. But then I have to ask the question myself. What happened to the two lost hours? Plus, the doctor does believe that we saw some aerial phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
and why
thoughts.
The amnesia on both Betty and my part?
Mm-hmm.
These are questions that would have to obviously follow through with the dream transference.
I think that Dr. Simon's disclaimer was a great deal more subtle, and I think more evasive than this gentleman states. I don't recall precisely what Dr. Simon said in either of the Look articles. I recall having read them, but they don't come back to my memory.
And I would like to say, too, that there were others in the area who had seen the UFO. So that part of it is not questioned. And, of course, the spots on the car were evident.
Yes, by other people.
First, I'd like to add my part to that, and then let Betty add hers. I did not carry on a conversation with these creatures, and at best that I could describe, I was treated very indifferent. The best that I could say is much like as if we found wild game in the wood, and we decided to capture it with the intentions of not harming it, but just to look at it and observe it, see what it's like, and then release it. There was complete indifference to me as an intellectual equal to them. This is, and plus, you have to also realize that that if the regressive hypnosis is factual, if this is an experience that Betty and I regressively had lived, then I would have been in a subdued situation at the time that I would have been on board this craft.
Barney, I would like to ask you a quickie, too, before I leave, and that is, of course, many contactees, as we refer to them, they'll say, well, we've been chosen, but do you personally believe, and you and Betty believe, that you were chosen or do you by these space creatures, or do you feel that if Alan or I had been there, that this would have happened to us instead?
I think if you had been there and had done what we had done, it would have happened to you.
Yes.
Betty and I, after she had seen this light star moving through the heavens, that when she brought it to my attention and we continued to drive, I think that would have been the only thing we would have seen. I really believe that by stopping the car occasionally, opening the door, causing the dome light to go on, we drew attention to us.
Yes.
And it was that kind of thing. We weren't chosen by any. I
feel that way, too. I'm glad you said that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Earl. And good night to you.
Thank you so much.
Good night, Earl.
Look
good night, Al. Barney, good night, Betty, and good night, Alan. Good night, everybody.
We're gonna go on now for just a few more minutes. But the Air Force called it Jupiter. Is that right, Betty?
Yes, this was in Project
Barney.
Well, they gave several explanations, I believe, the Air Force had at one time or another.
Inversion was one of them, wasn't it?
There was a possibility of an air inversion of the planet Jupiter, and I believe that the last report was insufficient evidence.
Mm-hmm. All right. It's interesting to note now that the Air Force has finally signed off. I'm sure everyone is aware of this and has awarded a $300,000 grant to the University of Colorado, who hereinafter will handle these cases and provide the documentation. As of now, the Air Force is definitely out of the fire, at least where you folks are concerned. You, either of you, I think perhaps Betty may be better able to answer that.
I think so. I only described the table that I was placed
yes.
on as being hard.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I could not say whether the walls were steel or plastic or just what they were. But I would say there was some kind of metal of some kind. Or it might have been a hard plastic.
Were you aware of any color?
No.
You were not?
It was a very barren room.
It was barren.
Yes, the only thing I noticed, Alan, is that the light system seemed to be of an indirect lighting system where I did not notice any bulb, but it was just light.
I have a couple of questions I want to ask both Barney and Betty, and then we're going to close the program. Betty and Barney, how do you both personally feel? Do you accept the truth of what you believe as the truth?
Alan, based on the evidence of the regressive hypnosis, I can only say that now the trip seems like, to me, a continuous trip where there is not the interruption, where it is as if I had taken a trip from here to Philadelphia mm-hmm. and am consciously aware of all the places I would pass.
Then,
or the stops I would make.
Then the information you now have as a result of the hypnotic regression seems like almost a fantasy to you.
Pardon me?
The information that you have as a result of... Do I understand you to say now that the entire trip seems now as a whole cloth?
Yes.
Everything that happened.
There's no longer the inner pressures, apparently. My ulcer has, I can say healed because it isn't bothering me.
I see.
And apparently there must have been something that created this tension that has been dissipated as a result of the hypnotherapy and
yes.
the therapy used by Dr.
Then you accept this.
I have to accept it,
and
Alan.
Betty?
As much as I find it difficult to do.
Betty, what about you?
I also accept that when Dr. Simon first discussed the possibility of the dream transference, I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically this was a very frightening, upsetting experience. I would say probably emotionally in the beginning would have about the same effect as being involved in a serious automobile accident. This
mm-hmm.
is my feeling about it.
Yes.
And so with this dream transference theory, I could say to myself that I could forget it, that it was nothing but a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept trying to tell myself this. But I could only do this for a short period of time. You know, and then I had the feeling that I was just kidding myself. And so it is. It's part of my reality. I really believe it actually happened.
The experience that you have heard tonight, ladies and gentlemen, from Betty and Barney Hill is an experience that I, and also Dr. Simon, believes these people implicitly accept as having happened to them. And it's interesting to note what Dr. Simon says in his introduction to his book. He says, in cases like the Hills, hypnosis can be the key to a locked room, the amnesic period. Under hypnosis, experience buried in amnesia may be recalled in a much shorter time than in the normal course of the psychotherapeutic process. Nevertheless, there is little produced under or by hypnosis that is not possible without. The charisma of hypnosis is tended to foster the belief that hypnosis is the magical and royal road to truth. In one sense, this is so, but it must be understood, says Dr. Simon, that hypnosis is a pathway to the truth as it is felt and understood by the patient. The truth is what he believes to be the truth, and this may or may not be consonant with the ultimate non-personal truth. Most frequently, it is, and I think that's a very interesting note to carry with us as we thank Betty and Barney Hill for this fascinating 2 hours tonight. I am very, very grateful to you, and I hope that if I ever get up to New Hampshire, that I'll have the opportunity to meet with you.
Colin, I certainly would enjoy having you visit. visit with us. We have a beautiful area here, and we could take a trip up to this section. Betty and I have located the spot.
Mm-hmm.
We never knew of this location until after we had been regressed back in that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have found what we believe strongly is the abduction point. And we both came to this conclusion, you might say, as we were going back over this area. And it seemed as if we had been there before, you might say.
Yes. Well, I would look forward to that, Betty and Barney. Both of you, thank you ever so much. I know you have an early day starting for you tomorrow over at the post office, and I do want to thank you again. And all best wishes to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Betty. Thank you, Barney. And good night.